Today's reading is from Luke. Now, during those days, he went to the mountain to pray, and he spent the night in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples and chose 12 of them, whom he called his apostles: Simon, who he named Peter, and his brother Andrew, and James, and John, and Philip, and Bartholomew, and Matthew, and Thomas, and James, son of Alphaeus, and Simon, who was called the Zealot, and Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God.
Well, I invite you to take out your sermon notes page and hopefully be of help as you reflect on the message today. Maybe take down notes that are helpful thoughts to you, especially if you're in a small group during this season of Lent and will be joining your group for discussion. We're going back to Oberammergau again today, the village in Germany that has the world's longest running passion play. And I might just say it's obvious that we're missing a few people today who may have forgotten to turn their clocks forward an hour last night. So take good notes and share it for somebody you know might not be here today. But I'm glad you're able to be here as we continue our series, because today we think about another unique aspect of this little town in the Alpine mountains of southern Germany that puts on this play. They do it once a decade. And the members of the cast, the people who help the sound and light and all aspects of the play, are volunteers. They're amateurs. They're not professionals. And think of the significance of that. A play that welcomes over 500,000 people from around the world and puts on over 100 performances in 1 year does not have professional actors. It's the people you bump into on the street, the hotel operators, the folks who own restaurants, the teachers, the farmers. They are the ones on the stage. A unique aspect even further is the fact that you have to have lived in Oberammergau for at least 20 years to be in the play. So if you are a ham and you say, I want to get on that stage, I'm even going to move to Oberammergau the year before the play so that I can audition and get in it, well, you're in for a rude awakening after you sell your house and you move there to find out, oh no, you've got 19 more years to go. And in this thought is an important message about community and the power of it. I got to be in Oberammergau on the most significant day of the decade for this town. It's not the year the play is performed. It's a year and a half before it starts, because on a Saturday in October, in this case, October of 2018, I was there for the naming of the cast. It is a big ceremony. It starts in the local church. And because only so many people can fit in the church, the rest of the crowd waits outside for the service to end. And then they move in procession through the town, eventually arriving where the rest of the town has gathered in the Passion Play Theater. You can see a children's choir beginning the ceremony now in the theater. They're singing. At some point in the ceremony, all of the town joins together in the historic vow that was made in 1633. Some of the names of the original 84 people who died are read to the crowd again. It reminds them of what precipitated the play being done, that the people prayed, God, if you will spare us any more deaths. And it's interesting that we're doing this series right now with our own fear of a spreading virus. But they made a vow, if you will spare us any more deaths, then every 10 years we'll put on a passion play. So they remember this. And then they all go outside to a courtyard in front of the theater. In front of them are a couple of large chalkboards with the names of the cast members, the ones who will be the leading characters and the ones who will be the understudies for all of the leading parts. When they're all gathered, the director of the play, the man you see on the right in this next picture, I think we've got it there. There he is in the white shirt over to the right, says a few words to the crowd, and then the names begin to be written on the chalkboard by each part being played, starting with Jesus. Nobody knows who it's going to be until they see the name written on the board. Now, as this was happening, I discovered I was standing next to Jesus. I have shaken Jesus' hand. Can you say that? In case you were in doubt of my level of holiness, I have been able to shake Jesus' hand. The first three letters of the word Frederick were written, and this person started to weep. He was with his wife and baby, which is perhaps another shocker that Jesus is married and has a child. But he started weeping because in the nearly 400 years of putting on this play, only a handful of people have ever been chosen to play Jesus twice. He was Jesus in 2010. He will be in 2020. The next person written in as the understudy is the youngest person ever selected to play that part. Here is a picture of the two of them together. As every name after began to be written, three or four letters in, the people there all knew who was about to be written, and they would begin clapping because it was their child, it was their next door neighbor, it was somebody in their family, it was a friend. And I realized standing there that day, I felt like I was crashing a family reunion, that this was a big deal. Imagine little children from the earliest years in school wondering, maybe one day I'll get to be in the Passion Play. Maybe I would get to be Jesus or a disciple or one of the leading characters of the story. And I just felt that standing there that day, that this was a powerful moment. You've heard the expression, it takes a village. Well, in Oberammergau, it takes a village to put on a Passion Play. And there's a great spiritual lesson there for us. That God chooses to tell God's story of love and redemption through community. It's the way God has always worked. It's always been in God's playbook to work that way. From the very beginning of history, God chose a nation of people to be God's light to the world. When God revealed himself in a new way and sent his son Jesus, Jesus called disciples to surround him. After his own death and resurrection, those disciples became the church. God continues to tell the story through community. I don't know that there's ever been a more important time for the church to live up to its call to be true community than now. We're in a time when it feels like we're as divided as ever, when we've lost the ability to practice civil dialogue. We need the church to demonstrate how to be true community. And yet the church struggles with that as much as anybody, doesn't it? We're coming up on another general conference 2 months from now in Minneapolis, in which we are facing a proposal that it looks like is going to pass that is going to separate our church, because there's a significant group that does not want to remain a part of the church if we differ in belief on certain scriptures. Even the church struggles with this. I read an article this week from the National Catholic Reporter talking not just about the Catholic Church, but the church in general. The challenge for our divided church today is not to find some elusive common ground, which in the nature of the thing will be thin and unsatisfying. Better to ask ourselves what those who view the relationship of Christ and culture differently from the way I do bring to the life of faith, and how my own faith and the life of the church might be strengthened if we learn to acknowledge each other's gifts and perspectives rather than convince each other that our way is the more faithful. Well, that pretty much sums it up, doesn't it? That's the great challenge of the church today, to live with our differences of opinion, but to still be united. It's tough to experience genuine community. It's tough in Oberammergau. Those of you in small groups, you're going to see the video this week, and in the video is an interview with the director of the play, Christian Stuckel. I got to ask him the day of the naming of the cast if we could do a short interview, and he said, yes, but today is so busy, would you come back tomorrow morning? The next day was Sunday. He said, meet me in the courtyard at 10:30. I said, great, I'll take whatever I can get. Next morning, I'm walking toward the courtyard. I see him already there in the distance, but I can tell he's talking to somebody. And I can tell the person he's talking to is not too happy. The person talking to him is making gestures like this constantly. And then he turns around and stomps off. When I got up to the director, he said, yesterday was a great day. All of the parents and the grandparents and the friends of the people I chose to be in the cast, they came up and patted my back. They hugged me. Today I'm hearing from the rest of the village. Community is even hard in a place where they put on the passion play. Makes me think about a quote from Bono, the lead singer of the rock group U2. He was asked one time about his faith. He said, you know what? I have no problem with Jesus. It's Christians I struggle with. Well, many of us could say the same, couldn't we? It's the behavior of many Christians that sometimes makes us wonder if we want to continue being one ourselves. So why does God choose to carry out God's purpose in the world through broken, imperfect, sin-filled people? Why does God's strategy include the church? Well, let's go back to the very seeds of the church's forming. It's not the day the Holy Spirit came upon the disciples. It's the day the disciples were chosen. That's the story we heard a moment ago. Think about the way the story begins. When morning came, he, being Jesus, called his disciples to him and chose 12 of them. Now notice that the 12 are not the only disciples. There are many, many more disciples than just the 12 Jesus chose. The word disciple means learner. One who learns. And the Gospels describe occasions when crowds of people who wanted to learn more about Jesus surrounded him, and that they were considered his disciples, but they could come and go at will. If they heard something that they didn't like, if Jesus challenged them to live in a certain way that they weren't willing to do, well, they just left. They quit. There's a story in John chapter 6 which follows a particularly tough teaching by Jesus, and it says many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. Discipleship was at will, but Jesus chooses from that number 12, and he designates them apostles. The word apostle means one who is sent. To be an apostle means that out of the crowd of easy followers are those who are called to represent the one who sends them. It's a higher level of commitment and responsibility. Let's think for a moment about who Jesus chose. In that group was a guy named Simon the Zealot. Who were zealots? Zealots were a band of people radically committed to the removal of foreign governments in their land. In this case, it was the Roman Empire. in the same group as a guy named Levi, the tax collector. Perhaps the source of greatest irritation to zealots was the collection of Roman taxes. That's because they had to pay it with a particular coin that had the inscription on it, "Caesar is God." To pay the tax, many Jews felt, was to commit idolatry. And within the group is a person who participates in that system. Don't you think Simon and Levi had some interesting conversations around the campfire at night? Then there were the brothers, James and John. They were called the Sons of Thunder. Why were they called that? My friend Tom Berlin wonders if that was because of all the beans and lentils that they ate, that they were called the Sons of Thunder. I don't think that's the reason. I think it describes their personalities, that they were just two people who, like some people, just bring static electricity into any gathering. Like they did the time they tried to outmaneuver the other disciples in getting positions of honor in Jesus' kingdom. And then it just caused this big fight that broke up their unity. Perhaps they were two people who, that's just how they were, sons of thunder. Then there was Judas Iscariot, who betrayed Jesus. Some people wonder if maybe a contributing factor to his betrayal was the fact he was the only non-Galilean in the group. He was the only Judean. That maybe he never fully felt like he was a part of the group. That the others had a way of letting him know, you're not one of us. You don't understand our customs. Maybe being a Judean, he was also more politically savvy. That what he was doing was not trying to betray Jesus. He was trying to broker a deal with the religious representatives. We'll think more about that in a few weeks. You put it all together, what do you take away? Community could not have been easy for the apostles. But if you're going to be an apostle, you not only have to be committed to Jesus, you have to be committed to each other. We make a big deal in the church of making disciples. We even say that that's the mission of the church. I wonder if we're using the wrong words. We're not trying to make easy followers. People who leave the minute they hear something that they disagree with. Maybe we should say we're making apostles. People who are as committed to each other as they are to Jesus. What does that look like? Years ago, I served a church that had two men in it as diametrically opposed to each other as two people could be, except for the fact that they were both white men with gray hair. Well, one of them didn't have much gray hair, but they were both older. One was very conservative. He was a layman. Let's just call him Mr. Conservative. The other was very liberal. He was a pastor. Let's call him Reverend Liberal. The one who was conservative politically and theologically. He was one of the founding members of the organization that today says we can no longer stay in the United Methodist Church. He was a founding member of that group. He was clear about what he believed. He was clear that we are to follow the Bible and that the Bible teaches us God's way and how to live. The other man, Reverend Liberal, was from South Carolina. He self-identified using his southern drawl as a yellow dog Democrat. He fervently believed that connection with Jesus means that we work toward a more just, inclusive, caring society, because that's what Jesus calls us to do. If you were to put these two people together, which I tried my best never to do, don't let them serve on the same committee, keep them as far apart as I can, because if politics comes up, it's gonna get ugly. If you start talking about theology and the troubles in the church, it's going to get ugly. But there was something funny about these two. They seem to respect each other's commitment to Christ. And because of that, they respected each other. A few months after I left that church, I got a letter one day from Mr. Conservative. He said, attached to this letter is a copy of my funeral service. I'm not dying, but whenever my funeral comes about, I will want the pastor serving my church at the time to conduct it, but if that person's unavailable, I want you to do it. So I looked at the order of his service. He had put the names of some of his best friends and former pastors and various people to do different things in the service, read scripture, do a prayer, and I'm looking down the order of the service, and my eyes about popped out when I saw Reverend Liberal's name in the order of service, that he would want that guy to help pay tribute to his life. Why? Because they found that in the church, you don't have to agree on everything to be community. You just need to love Jesus the same and let that be your uniting factor. They were apostles. And they're both in heaven now. And whenever a thunderstorm comes up, I assume they're talking politics or something. But to me, they showed me what church can look like. But it doesn't answer the question, why? Why does God do it that way? Let's assume for a moment that the purpose of the church is to teach us the right things to believe so that one day we go to heaven too. Now, some people would argue that if that's the purpose, you don't need other people for that. All you need is the right book, the right information. You don't need people to think right, right? Some people would say that being right is what gets in the way of relationships. But humor me for a moment, and let's assume that the purpose of the church is to teach us the right things to believe. What's the most important thing we should believe then? Not that. Let's think about some different beliefs about God. There's the belief in God's omnipotence, the belief God is all-powerful. There's the understanding of God's omniscience, the belief that God is all-knowing, the belief in God's omnipresence, the belief that God is everywhere, on and on and on we could go. What's the most important thing to believe about God? The founder of Methodism, John Wesley, helps us with that. This is what he said is the most important thing to believe about God. For the early Methodist, he created a coat of arms, and below the crest, he wrote the three-word scripture sentence from 1 John chapter 4, verse 12. God is love. God is love. For Wesley, that's the most important. He said, now, I'm not saying other doctrines are unimportant. They're important too. He wrote about many of these doctrines, but he would say that to miss this one is to render null and void all of the others. That we must have a firm grasp on the fact that God is love. Just say it with me. God is love. God is what? Who is love? God not was love. God not is going to be love. God what? God's love. Wesley said that's the most important. To miss that is to miss everything. Now think about this. If that's the case, that's the one belief that we cannot receive alone. It's the one doctrine, it's the one understanding of God that you can't have it living by yourself. You can have the others alone. You can receive the others as information. But love, well, how do you define love if it's not other people? The only way we understand love is through relationship. And if we are to understand the core fundamental essence of who God is, it means we've got to have community. I heard a youth speaker one time share with the teenagers who were present about his infant daughter and how he and his wife purchased for their infant daughter a little Pictionary Bible. Thick pages, they didn't tear, they had pictures of Bible stories, and even better, you could chew on it. So it served several purposes for their child. Whenever their child got fussy, they would bring her the picture Bible. Here's your picture Bible. She'd put it in her mouth and she was happy. Or they would show her the pages and she would see all the images and kind of smile. She'd be satisfied. But one day she pinched her finger in a little place on the crib. He ran in there to see what was wrong. He saw it. He kissed her finger. She kept crying. He said, "Well, look, here's your picture Bible." She kept crying. "Look here, look at the pages. See all the pictures?" She kept crying. Nothing was working. He finally laid down the picture Bible and picked her up and started patting her head, and she calmed down. He said, "Is this not what we all need? That when we're hurting, we don't need somebody to throw the book at us. We need love. And you only know and experience love and community. That's what's most important. What if God's great desire for us is not to know all the right information, but to be the right kind of people? And what if being the right kind of people is to love the way Jesus loved?" I was in a meeting this past week with a few pastors, and one of them was Reverend Mary Dickens. She's the associate pastor at Meridian Street Methodist. She told a story about when she was a pastor in Tennessee. Her church hosted a series of workshops on race relations. The presenter asked if she would help lead the workshops, and she agreed. As they were planning them and getting ready, the presenter said, "Now, we're going to need a strong session to talk about white supremacy. Why don't you do that, Mary?" Remember, the church is in Tennessee. So she agreed. She led this workshop where she was trying to demythologize what white supremacy looks like. That it's not the Confederate flag waving gun in the rear window of your truck toting individual. It's about a system in society that favors one race over another, and it's subtle. 2 days later, a member of her church, a man who had been attending that workshop, was in her office and was so mad she feared it could be to the point of violence. He was yelling, screaming in anger about how dare she suggest that they could contribute to a system labeled as white supremacy. When he finally calmed down, she said, "Why don't you keep coming to the group? And why don't you share with them your feelings? Just share with them what you've just shared with me." So he did, but he didn't share. He waited until the last session. When everybody was asked what they had gotten out of the experience and if they had anything to contribute, "Come up to the mic." He went up to the microphone. He began this way: "Reverend Mary told me I should tell you this." She just froze. He said, "I let her know that the first night I was angry when we talked about white supremacy," and he shared his reasons why. He said, "But then he reflected on something that he had done some years before when he was a part of a company. Whenever he was hiring people for jobs, if he saw on their application that they had attended the all African American university, he threw out the application. If they even had a name that sounded African American to him, he threw out the application." Now the rest of the group was starting to get angry. and thinking of the audacity of this man to stand there and say what he's saying. He said, I justified it because I figured I was doing people a favor. Because I knew what my company is like and I knew how they would be treated. I thought I was sparing them. But I've come to realize I was denying people a job. I was denying people the freedom to choose for themselves. I suppose I was contributing to white supremacy. That didn't happen because he read a book. It happened through community. Maybe God knows what he's doing after all.